You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and it's our Going Native segment. Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph, is my guest. And this next plant that we're going to suggest for you to grow in your garden is the desert holly. And I always have issues with Latin, wondering how to pronounce them, because I know how to pronounce Spanish. So in Spanish, this would be Mahonia fremonti. But that's not how you would say it in Latin. So,
or in English.
Okay.
Mahonia fremonti.
Okay, so kind of a little closer. So what is it about the desert holly that you like?
Very, very drought tolerant.
You have down here a superior shrub for Utah gardens.
In the right place. You don't want to plant it next to your front porch. The leaves are small. They're real pretty gray blue in the summer. In the winter, they turn real pretty burgundy color. Beautiful in a winter flower arrangement, a winter arrangement. But they are very prickly. And so it makes a really nice screen. If you've got an area you don't want people to walk through or you don't like your neighbors, you can plant this desert holly.
And it's an evergreen?
It is evergreen. Like I said, the leaves in the wintertime, the leaves turned from blue to a deep burgundy.
So not necessarily neighbor friendly, but pollinator friendly.
Extremely pollinator friendly. The flowers, if you ever stick your nose in a jar of honey and take a deep whiff, that's what the flowers smell like, like honey. And the bees love them.
How tall does it get?
In my garden, I want it to get 4 feet tall. In the wild, they can get 5 feet, 5 feet tall and maybe 6 feet wide. They can be kind of gangly, wild-looking in the wild, but in the yard, they're very nice-looking. With that little bit of extra watering, not having to worry about the hot desert, sunny wind, they do really nice. They're very attractive.
Do you have to prune them back at all?
I do, because I don't want them to get that big, and I want my yard to look like a garden tended and not like a wildscape.
Okay. When you say it's not neighbor-friendly, does it have spines or anything on it?
Or no. It's just like a holly leaf. Just like a holly leaf.
So if you happen to fall into it, it'll just be a little uncomfortable, but it's not like you're going to be stuck with a lot of little barbs.
Right.
Okay. Fragrant yellow flowers.
Just so fragrant, and the bees love them. And They will grow in the wild, they grow in full sun. But, you know, just to say full sun in the wild, usually these plants are growing in a canyon somewhere. So that's not really full sun, because in a canyon you'll get shade either in the morning or the afternoon.
One of the things that we haven't really talked about in this segment yet are plants that produce more the berries rather than just the seeds. Okay. And this is one that will produce berries for the birds.
Oh, absolutely. The robins love this. And that's the one bird I do recognize. And I do have a lot of robins. And I have other interesting birds. But they love that berry. And they're always, all winter long, scratching around underneath those to get those berries.
Looking for the berries that have dropped.
And they're so ornamental, too. Just the most interesting rose-colored berry.
Where does it grow? Where do you usually see it? You mentioned in canyons.
Right. Well, it grows all through southern Utah. Just about in every national park, you'll see it growing in every national park and everywhere in between.
So it must be pretty much adapted to most soil types.
Right.
Dry clay or rock, gravelly soil. That's nice.
Right. And I know it's cold hardy up here.
Yeah, zone 3 to 6.
Right. And they've had some growing at the University of Utah campus for quite a few years.
Best location in the full sun. Will grow a little bit in partial shade. Would you use this as a specimen plant?
I do. Yes, I do.
What would you pair with it?
I like four-winged saltbush. And I like the ephedra just because of the contrast with the different leaf shapes and the different leaf colors.
And how long do you see the flowers on it when it is in blossom?
For quite a while. Like I said, with a little additional water, they'll last longer. And I do collect the seed off of the plants. And so I do need it to flower longer and to make that seed. And so by that, I mean once every 2 weeks I water.
And I love that it's an evergreen.
Oh, it's yes, it's amazing. Between that and the Mormon tea, the ephedra, they're two really nice plants. Mm. But you do have to have it in the right spot in your garden.
And this plant is the desert holly, and it's our recommendation on our Going Native segment. Jeanette Warner is owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. Jeanette, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Coming up now is an interview, and I am looking so forward to this. On the line with me from somewhere, I believe, on the East Coast is Catherine Alto. She is the author of The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-Acre Wood. Catherine is a landscape designer, historian, writer, and speaker living in Exeter, England. American by birth, she has master's degrees in garden history and creative nonfiction, with a particular interest in literary landscapes. Passionate about walking and natural history, she recently completed the coast-to-coast walk across England with her family. So welcome to the program, Catherine.
Hi, great to be here. And I am in Albany, New York.
Okay.
I just checked my watch. That's where I am.
So we're 2 hours behind you, and I appreciate your flexibility this morning. I know, just the front page of the book is what just sucks me right in. First, it's Winnie the Pooh. Who has not read a book about Winnie the Pooh? And if you haven't, you must read these books by A.A. Milne. And I wanted to start out asking, so what first attracted you to writing this book in the first place?
Well, the answer is a long one, and I'll try to shorten it. But it was a book many years in the making. And it started when I moved to England. So in 2007, my husband got a great job as a university professor at the University of Exeter. So we left what we call our own 100-acre wood. It's about 20 acres outside of Seattle, about 20 miles northeast of Seattle in the Pacific Northwest. And we moved with our three children, who were roughly about 3, 6, and 9 at the time. And I remember flying from Seattle to Dublin, and then the last leg, Dublin to Exeter, I was looking down on this landscape from the prop plane thinking, what have we done? I mean, we had this idea of having an adventurous chapter of our lives abroad. But I looked down and I didn't see the American West. Of course, it's England. I saw a beautiful quilted ancient hedgerow landscape, which actually when you're in it, it feels like Teletubby land. It's beautiful green rolling hills. And I needed to get to know the place. So within the first couple days of living there, I stumbled across a book on walking in England. And before the jet lag wore off, we had actually clocked in about, 20 miles on these wonderful public footpaths. And at the same time, I was reading classic books to my children. I've always read aloud to them. And I was reading Mark Twain, and I was reading the Brer Rabbit stories and some other ones, including Winnie the Pooh. I like to return and reread the classics. So one thing led to another, and because we were walking a lot, and because I taught American Literature of Nature and Place, and I'm a landscape historian, and I was walking with my children, I thought, is there a 100-acre wood? And was there a real Christopher Robin? And could we walk there? It was really that simple and that complex mixed together. So a few years later, we have the book that you're looking at right now.
So tell me, what did you discover along those footpaths in that first 20 miles?
Well, I discovered that England is, it fits in the bottom of my home state of California, but it feels much bigger because the footpaths allow you to walk at kind of a naturalist pace, 1, 2, 3, 4 miles an hour, something like that, probably less 4 miles an hour. But so you see the world at a really slow pace. It's a great way of getting to know a place well, to develop that sense of place. And sense of place is that, from a geographer's viewpoint, it's that invisible layer of history and emotions in a certain place. So it's like if you can imagine an emotional strata overlaying a physical landscape. That's what I was feeling when I was walking on these public footpaths. I was, you know, getting to know what the place felt like and smelled like and felt like under my boots. And so there's this, not many people know outside of England, but there's this ancient network of public footpaths. So I live in the southwest, which is about 200 miles southeast of England, in my town. I could walk up to the Hebrides in Scotland if I wanted, just on public footpaths. So the walking in England changes your perception of what it feels like to live there. So England feels much bigger to me than all of the United States, actually. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's because I can experience it in a different way. It's not, you know, England wasn't set out as a car culture. So we don't, of course we have highways or, you know, motorways and so forth. But so these public footpaths really change your perception of living there. And a lot of different writers have been influenced by being able to get out into the landscape, and so was A.A. Milne, and that's what I learned. He had an extraordinary childhood of walking and exploring in the 1880s when he was a child with his older brother. So we can get into talk about it later, but that's where the stories were inspired, where they got their inspiration. He was remembering his own childhood. He was watching his own Christopher Robin play in a landscape where he moved, Ashdown Forest, and he was using his own writerly imagination to make them fun and playful and clever for children.
So did you find that after you had moved and been there for a couple of years, did you find that your children played differently than they did when they were in Washington? I know they still had their kind of own woods in Washington, and I remember when I lived in Washington, the woods that I would play in, but I can imagine the countryside being a little bit different, and with all the footpaths, that just says, follow me. If I'm on a footpath, I just keep going.
Yeah, yes. No, it's what you're saying is how we feel, for sure. They do play differently. I would say when we go out onto a public, you know, we often do circular walks, for example. So we'll start at a village that has a... I will select walks. You know, we do a lot of walking where we live, just right outside our door. But if I want to experience a new place, I will open up, you know, a handbook and look up, you know, the length of it. So it'll often be a 6, 8, 10 mile circular walk. So we drive to this village, and it'll, you know, it's a pretty typical to start in a village with an old Norman or Norse name, and pass through a flock of sheep where the farmer has a sign up that says, a little sign that says, please close the gate behind you, instead of, you know, get off my property. So you can walk through, you know, pastures of animals. You can pass through a stone circle or an earthen mound from the Bronze Age and end at a pub that was established in, you know, the 15th century and have your Sunday roast there. So that's a very typical thing for us to do as a family on a Sunday. And so that, I would say, walking is definitely a bit of a play for us, too. It's an all-day kind of thing. We go slowly. There's lots of talking, lots of playing, lots of stopping. Of course, you know, two of them are teenagers now. They're now 12, 15, and 18. So, but they still love to walk. And, but, yeah, I would say that, you know, they would stop a lot and look at pick up toads, or they will pick wildflower bouquets. So it's a different kind of play. On the farm where we lived, you know, they could go play in the salmon spawning stream, or they play in the meadow, or gather eggs from the chickens. So it's just sort of a different way of engaging with the landscape as children.
So these pathways, they're public pathways, but they must really predate then cars, automobiles. That's how towns and communities were connected. So they're hundreds of years old?
Hundreds and hundreds of years old, yeah. So there are, the roads now, are, you know, especially where I live, they're very narrow because you encounter another car and often you end up having to back up on the lanes. The paths, we have what's called a legal right to roam. So these footpaths are all over. They're bridleways for horses and people, and then they're pathways, you know, which are narrow trails. And people would be, you know, paths that villagers would take from like a hamlet to a market, or a path that people would take from the village to the church, or village to village. So these have never had cars on them. They're narrow. They look like, you know, one or two people have walked on them side by side. Usually it feels like, you know, one person has. They're like from a dream. It's a dreamy way of being on the land that we just don't have them here in the United States. Here we have wonderful national parks here that England doesn't have. We have big charismatic megafauna, you know, like wolves and bears and so forth, which we don't have in England. But it's the gentle way of strolling and ambling is so easy there. It's just a very different way of engaging.
I want to start with your book, with the introduction, because this really, to me, I love food. My grandmother's cooking and my mom's cooking. So the introduction says, reading A.A. Milne's stories for children is like tasting my grandmother's lemon meringue pie. The crust, tangy curd, and pile of meringue transport me to frothy, faraway days. In California summers, my large family gathered together in the dappled light of my grandparents' garden, and there were always lemon meringue pies. Those were carefree and fleeting times when the most important thing I had to consider was which tree to climb and what direction to wander. The pie and these books are bound in nostalgia for bygone days. Can we capture that still today? Because I'm thinking of when I was growing up and the exploration that I used to do. And I don't see that with children very much anymore. So it gives me heart to know at least somewhere that there is a place that encourages that kind of exploration.
Yeah, I would say that I think children are natural explorers. Children want to, they're naturally curious. They want to go out, and they're fascinated by the sort of dust on the backs of moths and butterflies, or what marigolds look like, or, you know, because the world is waking up, the real world is waking up for children, you know, around, you know, three onwards. And children are natural, like I said, naturally curious. I think it's the parents that often need to be retrained. You know, it's just really important for children to be able to have time in the natural world away from the watchful eyes of parents to do nothing, that we don't always need to overschedule our children. I think I'm the opposite of, you know, tiger mothers, which is, yes, my children do play violin, you know, there's structure, but there's also time to think and to dream. So I think in a way it's the parents who need to be reminded, and I hope my book does that in a way. I hope my book is a kind of a field guide for parents to give their children more freedom. It's, some people have dubbed my book the field guide for the free-range child through Winnie the Pooh, because in the stories, of course, we have Christopher Robin wandering alone in this landscape with his chums, and his chums are wandering around, and they're having these lovely, tender adventures in this 100-acre wood. And so that sparked my curiosity when I initially was thinking about the topic. You know, who was this child, and who was inspired to write these stories? And I think that we can learn from them. And in my book, I hope people can let children enjoy the original stories before they read my story, my interpretation of the real places. But then if people are inspired, you know, you can go to the sections on Poustik's Bridge, or learn about the history behind the Enchanted Place, or the Heffalump Traps, or Eeyore's Gloomy Spot. It's all in there. So it's a mixture of learning about the landscape and learning about literature at the same time. So there's several threads woven together in my book.
We're talking about The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-Acre Wood. I have the author, Catherine Alto, online. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Perhaps you've been inspired about nature by reading Winnie the Pooh, or just have something to a remembrance. Toll free 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So I was reading in your book that A.A. Milne and had his brother was his closest companion, Ken. And they could pretty much, if they got up early in the morning, as long as they didn't wake their parents, they could do pretty much anything.
They did. They had the complete trust of their parents. And this was in the 1880s in Victorian London. And so their father was their teacher, and he was also the headmaster at the school, which they ran in sort of an adjacent building to their house. So the rule was they could do whatever they wanted as long as they were at their desk by 7 a.m. So in the summers, if you can imagine, the sun's coming up by 4:40 in the morning, and so they would go run hoops through cobblestone Victorian streets in London. And he writes, well, two-thirds of his autobiography, It's Too Late Now, is devoted to his childhood. So for the creator of the Winnie the Pooh stories to devote that much time, you realize that he had an amazing time, and he did, and it was really his adventures with Ken. His there were three Milne boys, Barry, Ken, and Alan. A.A. Milne stands for Alan Alexander Milne, and each boy, they were 16 months apart. But Ken and Alan were companions, and they looked almost identical. They had long flaxen hair and blue eyes, and their mother didn't cut their hair until they were 11 years old. So they looked a bit on the wild side. But Alan was a very, very good student, very bright, incredibly bright. He was the youngest Queen's Scholar ever at Westminster School. He was very good at mathematics, and he was an enthusiast. He really loved everything. So his father completely trusted him, and he loved his father, and he would never have done anything to have broken that trust. So because of that, they had complete freedom. So I include in the book a letter, his first published story was about a trek that he took, an 18-mile walk that he took actually in Ashdown Forest with his older brother.
Was he eight?
Alone. 8 years old.
Yeah, 8 years old. I couldn't believe that. I'm like, okay, well, I remember riding my bike across the valley here, which would have been about 8 miles, to go see a movie and do stuff on my own when I was like 11, but 8 years old, that seemed quite young. But again, it was a different time.
It was a different time, but imagine the freedom that you felt cycling and the way he felt and what he wanted to give his son. And so when we read the stories, there's that sense of, the book sort of capture quintessential childhood. If we think of, like, well, we want to give our children a classic childhood, often it has to do with a lot of time outdoors and reading to our children. So again, it's that confluence of literature and landscapes mixed together.
And often there's a dog involved with this, and in this case,
there's a dog
Brownie.
Involved. Brownie's involved, yeah. Brownie was their loyal companion, and I include some anecdotes of finding a toad with Brownie and what happened to that toad. So the stories that these two boys had, the adventures that they had, you know, we're with them until Ken died in his late 40s, I believe, and they could just look at each other and say, for example, a code of FN, and it was a funny code that they created for the time they found the toad that I just mentioned, and what happened to the toad,
the poor toad.
To me is probably one of the funniest parts of part one in my book. Do you remember that part?
Yes.
Yeah.
I won't divulge what happens, but it's just amazing how much is spent on that. I'll never forget that toad. And if I remember correctly, they had a password between he and Ken, and like 20 years later, they could say the password, and each one of them would completely know what the other was talking about.
Yeah, and it was they could just remember if they were in Sunday school in starch suits, or if they were middle-aged men, they could look at each other and go FN and be transported back to that particular afternoon, capturing that particular toad, and they ended up putting the toad in a drawer, and I won't say anymore.
Okay, well let's head into some of the actual place. So they lived in London, and then they would spend weekends. at Hartfield Village. Is that where they were doing, or is that where they eventually ended up buying the home?
Yeah. So Christopher Robin was born in 1920, and in 1925, when he was almost five, he was still four at the time, they bought Cotchford Farm, and so they spent every summer out there and every long weekend and holidays there. So they spent a great deal of time, and then eventually they moved down there full-time. It's outside of the village of Hartfield a little bit. I don't want to reveal exactly where it is, and I try not to say where the Milne family lived, but it's called Cotchford Farm. I'm trying to protect the privacy of the owners there now. Mm-hmm. So I don't. That's one area where I'm a little bit coy with readers. I don't like to locate exactly where it is. So they moved there, and it's on the edge of Ashdown Forest, and Ashdown Forest is a 6,000-acre forest, not in the American sense that we know forest. It's about 60% heathland and 40% woodland, and they lived on the edge of it, and they were lifelong walkers, and were able to give their son the kind of childhood that they had. Daphne, his wife, and A.A. Milne did. A lot of the origins of the stories that we know so well took place right there at Cotchford Farm, but others took place on out in the forest. And that's, I write about 20 of those places in the second part of my book about, you know, where the origins of the stories.
Well, let's talk about Pooh's house. That's very close to the main part of the farm.
It is. So Pooh's house was inspired by A.A. Milne watching Christopher Robin play in a big gash in a walnut tree. So an ancient walnut tree is one that lives between 200 to 300 years old, 300 and they're about the end of their lifespan. But there was a great gash in it, so big that a 5 to 6-year-old boy could sort of stand in it. And so he would create, Christopher Robin would go into this center of this big tree and have play with his stuffed animals. And he was an only child. He was really shy, very, very shy, like Milne's father was too. J.V. Milne, his father, was very shy. So Christopher Robin got that shy gene. So he did have playmates, but he really loved imaginative play with his stuffed animals. So A.A. Milne watched his son playing, and that's where the very first Winnie the Pooh story started, was watching Christopher Robin play. And the cover of the book has the picture of Christopher Robin inside this tree, and you can see the real Winnie the Pooh, and I think there's Piglet poking out at the top.
Was he secretive about this place as a child? Did he like to share it with others or keep it to himself?
Well, that's a good question. When he was alone, it was fine, but he had a very good friend named Anne, and Milne writes stories about Anne and Buttercups, not stories, but poetry about her. So that's not included in this book, although there is one black and white E. H. Shepherd sketch of Anne and Christopher Robin together. But Anne would come visit, and the tree was too small for two people, so he said, well, you can have the well house. So she built a little, you know, if you imagine little kids playing, she built a little, created her own little house there. And so they were kind of neighbors, so to speak. They had their separate spaces.
And I understand that the walnut is no longer there. It was gone in about the early 70s.
That's right. It came down in the early 70s, but it was an entrancing entrance to Cotchford Farm. Was there for a couple of centuries. Yeah, I'm no longer there. So for places that are no longer there, what I do is, as a historian, is I create an image and what it would have felt like and what places would have been like. This is what the tree would have looked like, and this is where it was located. And so there's a lot of background information on a few of the places that are no longer there, because landscapes, as you know, they're living and breathing. So they, you know, rivers meander, they change the landscape, trees grow and die, fires go through. In the case of Ashdown Forest, a hurricane came through in 1987. So landscapes change. But for the places that are still there, I definitely write about those. I take pictures. I'm the photographer for the book as well. So I bring people in to real places, and for the places that are no longer there, I create images for people.
Well, and I love how you interweave illustrations from the books with your own photographs, and because it really gives you a sense of place of both the stories and real life.
It does, and walking there in the real landscape, it does feel like walking through an E.H. Shepherd drawing, the forest really does look like it did when Christopher Robin wandered around. So say we're out there in August, in September, you would see a beautiful tapestry of gold and purple from the heathers and the gorse. There are two kinds of gorse. There are European gorse and a dwarf gorse. So there's an old English saying that kissing's in season when gorse is in bloom. It's always in bloom there. So, and it has the faint smell of coconut. And there are, it's beautiful on the top of the forest. It's called Jill's Lap, and that's called Galleon's Lap in the story. And there's lovely white sand that is really fine, and it feels like pixie dust, and you're up on the top of the forest. You feel like you can practically throw a stone to France or smell crepes from Normandy. It's that close. It's lovely. And there's real fresh breezes up there. Yes.
I was going to say, one of the best pictures in here that I love, and maybe because I'm a gardener at heart anyway, but you have this two-page photo of a field of rapeseed that's near Hartfield,
right.
And it's absolutely gorgeous. It's just complete yellow.
It is complete yellow.
With the beaches poking up above it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was one of those things that you learn as a photographer. If you see something and you react really emotionally to it, you have to turn your car around, or you have to go back to that spot that has not left your mind. And that was the case. I probably spent an hour out photographing that particular field, which is adjacent to Hartfield. But it really does look like that. So you can get a shock of purple in a woods full of English bluebells, and then go by a sunny field of rapeseed and have that glorious, bright yellow against a blue sky. It almost feels like you're in Provence, and alas, you're in England.
Mm. Well, give us a sense of place now with Eeyore's house. Is it as gloomy as his disposition?
Well, that's an interesting place. That's an interesting one. I think if it were to be cited in a real place, Christopher Robin, the real Christopher Robin, Christopher Milne, said it would have been located in a pasture where they really had a donkey named Jessica. And it was kind of a wasteland. I wouldn't say that. I mean, some people might call it a wasteland. You and I would say, well, it's a wetland. It's a bit wet there. And I actually walked from Cotchford Farm to the river that where Pustick's Bridge is, and that's where I encountered these two donkeys. So Christopher Robin, if pressed, would say that could have been like the real physical place where the stories would have been would have had its origins. But in real life, he also would have said that Eeyore's gloomy place was like a psychological place for his father, A.A. Milne was very English and reserved and kept his feelings to himself. And so if he was feeling sad or down about something, he could have channeled that into a character. And it could have been instructive to his own child, too. I mean, if you know that the stories are written in a dual narrative, so they're written for adults as well as the children mm-hmm. they're reading to. And so it could have been a way, where children could adults could say, or children could feel that there was a place or there was an animal that could be a companion in sadness for them.
Well, we only have about 4 minutes left. This is one of those interviews I wish I had the whole hour to do, because it's just, it's marvelous to me, and I would love to go there, and I hope I will someday be able to walk through and see this, and your book helps us do that. This is The Natural Wood of Winnie the Pooh, a walk through the forest that inspired the 100-acre wood, and I'm talking with the author, Catherine Alto. Let's move along quickly to Piglet's House. This one was interesting to me.
Yes. Well, let me just say about Eeyore's house, you can find them. They pop up all over. People go to the woods to build these little wooden tents. So, right.
Okay, good.
As Piglet's house was inspired by, well, all the little animals live in little houses, and of course Rabbit lives in a burrow in the ground, and there are rabbits, there's a big rabbit history in the forest, but for Piglet, yeah, it was any tree that you can find that has, you know, another gash in it. So Piglet was very small, and the world to him was very big, and he was very timid. So he had a little hole in the tree, and I come up with equivalents for those in the landscape.
Now, tell me where his house is situated, because he's got this sign. It's kind of a broken sign. It says, "Trespassers will be prosecuted." Why would he have that kind of sign there at his home? And is it related to where it is in the woods?
No, I would say that would have just plucked from anywhere. I think that on the edge between the 100-acre, I'm sorry, on the edge between Ashdown Forest and there's a real place called the 500-acre wood, mm-hmm. where Milne derived the name, that you can find their property boundary signs that say, you know, private property. That's pretty rare in England, but you can see that. So it could have been somebody had put up a sign that said that, and or E.H. Shepherd just could have used his own imagination. But I like that in that story that Piglet thinks it's that's his, you know, grandfather, mm-hmm. or whoever. Trespassers W.
Water also plays an important part in the writings of Milne and how it influenced him. Tell me about the water and in this particular area.
Right, so there is a tributary to the Medway River that runs adjacent to Cotchford Farm, and it is where it's the water, the flowing water there is where Poustic's Bridge is located. So in real life, the real Christopher Robin would go out during floods and put a stick everywhere. Every morning he would go out and put a stick where the river was rising. And that influenced the story of Winnie the Pooh's house being flooded and having to rescue Piglet. So that's where that story comes from. But it's also, it trickles through through the forest, and it's also the place where the source where Poustic's Bridge is played. Poustic's is played on a bridge over that tributary.
Well, I was first influenced by the Disney cartoons, and so the first thing in my mind when I think of Winnie the Pooh is the oak tree and Pooh climbing that oak tree and humming the song to get to the honey at the top, and the little black rain cloud. This is just marvelous.
Yeah. That is really marvelous. I'm less familiar with Disney. I'm a real purist. I stuck to the the classic stories, which I would encourage everyone to read. Some people don't even know that they were written in the 1920s and that there are they are classics, and they're around for a reason as classics. But that you're referring to the very first Winnie the Pooh story, where mm-hmm. he's trying to get honey and he rolls in some mud, and then he needs to disguise. He needs to get up into the top of the bee tree, the honey tree, to get it. But he has to fool the bees, too. So he goes up in a blue balloon. And the only violence, it's not even violence, Christopher Robin's asked to bring out his court gun. Of course, we know it's not shooting anything.
Yes.
And he shoots Pooh down, and he escapes. And I don't think he gets any honey in the end.
Well, in 30 seconds, can you tell me what would you do if you've never been there before? What's the first thing that you would do when you arrive at Ashdown Forest?
The first thing I would do is go to the top of the forest where you can find, you're at the very top, you can go to the Enchanted Place, which is a cluster of trees. It's a lovely place where Christopher Robin in the story says goodbye to childhood. I think that story evokes more tears in people around the world than any other of the Milne stories. Then I would wander off to the Milne Memorial, which is nearby, unmarked, so people can discover it on their own, to Rue's Sandy Pit, and then I'd go play Poustic's at Poustic's Bridge, and wander around, connect some, walk through the forest, walk through the heathland, and end at the Hatch Inn, which is a pub where I wrote the book, established in 1430. So you can get the full English experience and Pooh Bear experience, too.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining me on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
The book is The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-Acre Wood by Catherine Alto. Coming up next is Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And today I'd like to read from a very fascinating book called How Plants Work by Linda Chucker Scott, The Science Behind the Amazing Things Plants Do. And it truly is an amazing book about our amazing plant kingdom. My first house was in Corvallis, Oregon, home of Oregon State University, where my husband and I were working on our PhD research in horticulture. Our tiny front yard had enough room for a single specimen tree, in this case, a lovely, bloodgood Japanese maple. We were eager to update the front entry and replaced the 1930s era concrete steps with a basket weave brick entry and a wooden deck. The design perfectly showcased our maple. We were thrilled with the transformation. Well, until next year. Suddenly, our maple didn't grow so well. Many of the branches died. Finally, it was in such dire straits that we dug it up and replaced it with a much smaller tree, which thrived. But what happened to the first tree? I asked one of my favorite professors at Oregon State about the tree's sudden demise. Jim Green was our department's extension specialist and didn't teach any of my graduate classes, but he was knowledgeable, easygoing, and had a wicked sense of humor. The graduate students loved him. Imagine my shock, then, when he turned visibly angry as I explained our landscaping changes and subsequent tree death. "What in the world do you think would happen?" he snapped. "When you disturbed the 75% of the tree's root zone in the middle of the summer." Well, we hadn't even thought about that. We dug up the existing lawn, laid down the bricks and deck timbers. I remember silently cursing the roots as we dug, and they were probably cursing us back. I felt stupid, not just because I had irked Jim, but because I hadn't foreseen these consequences myself. After all, I was getting a PhD in horticultural plant physiology. In hindsight, I think this was a defining moment for me, though I didn't know it at the time. I do know that it was during this time that I became more curious as to how plants responded to different environmental stresses, besides dying, of course. Over 3 decades, I evolved from a laboratory plant physiologist studying how plants function and interact with their environment to an applied urban horticulturalist and finally to an extension specialist at Washington State University. Though my career continued to change, my interest in how plants work only became more engrossing. I combed through articles on soil science, arboriculture, environmental horticulture, and restoration ecology, as well as those of the more traditional botany and horticulture journals. While botany books describe leaves and roots in isolation from each other and therefore have chapters called the leaf or the root, physiology is the study of systems. It is impossible to explain the physiology of a leaf or a root because their functions are influenced by other plant parts. It would be like describing how a heart works without mentioning the lungs that provide the oxygen or the arteries and veins that deliver and return blood. Instead, plant physiology textbooks have chapters on photosynthesis, mineral uptake, and flowering. However, it can be difficult to make these conventional topics both accessible and interesting to the non-scientist. Current books on plant physiology are primarily focused on newer research at the molecular and genetic levels. The content is timely and important, but boy, does it turn off your young average gardener who probably sees no practical connection between gene regulation in corn and the corn growing in the backyard vegetable garden. What we gardeners want to know is how plants work so that we can have gardens and landscapes that are healthy, beautiful, and don't need constant additions of fertilizers and pesticides. So this book is structured a bit differently. Each chapter opens with a real-life situation, often something in my own garden, that I invite you to explore with me. Then I integrate the science as needed to answer questions that gardeners invariably have. I've tried to include all the practical topics you would find in a textbook with examples and illustrations to make the science useful and easily understandable. Now I'll skip to what seemed timely to me, his chapter on why leaves can turn red anytime, any place. I'm a lucky gardener because I live in a region with distinct seasons. I actually enjoy storing summer clothes and rediscovering what's in my wintry wardrobe. Likewise, my garden packs away its languid summer greens, replacing them with bold reds, oranges, and yellows. If you're the fanciful type, you may like the notion of Jack Frost painting the autumn leaves. And indeed, cooler night temperatures speed up autumn color transformation. But wait a minute. Some plants have leaves that turn red in midsummer, or some whose leaves are red when they're young and then turn green, and some whose leaves are always red. Why do leaves turn red anyway? It seems as though plants possess more pigments than an artist's palette. That's because light is one of the most important and reliable environmental signals plants receive. Pigments select and collect particular wavelengths of light for photosynthesis and other botanical business. The pigments that reflect and transmit most of the red, blue, and purple colors we see in leaves, flowers, and fruits are anthocyanins, a name that literally means flower pigment. Unlike chlorophyll and carotenoids, nested cosily in chloroplasts, anthocyanins are water-soluble mobile pigments that can scoot easily within and between cells and tissues. Anthocyanins are multipurpose molecules. Their mobility in water means they can be used as cellular transport systems. Sugars, metals, and other substances can be hooked onto anthocyanins and zipped off to other parts of the plant that need them. Anthocyanins are also a natural sunscreen. Under full sun conditions, they can protect chloroplasts from solar overload by siphoning off some of the incoming energy. They're also powerful antioxidants, meaning they can protect plant cells from all kinds of environmental stressors. This is why nutritionists recommend that we eat so many red and blue fruits and vegetables. These antioxidants are beneficial to us too. With the advantages that anthocyanins offer plants, the curious gardener might wonder why all leaves aren't red. To answer this, let's look at some tree cultivars that have been deliberately selected for their permanent red foliage. There are several flowering crabapples with various hues of red foliage available at most nurseries, and many of these have been grafted onto a green-leafed rootstock. If we were to study these leaves in the landscape, we'd come across several green-leaved suckers threatening to overtake the red-leaved scion. Clearly, the rootstock of these crabapples is more vigorous. It turns out that anthocyanins are expensive to manufacture. Their synthesis takes chemical energy that the plant could otherwise funnel into growth. Even worse, these pigments can interfere with photosynthesis, further reducing the plant's energy reserves. Okay, now it sounds as though I've just contradicted myself. How can anthocyanins interfere with photosynthesis if they're not in the chloroplast? Let's review what pigments do with light. Chlorophyll looks green because it absorbs red and blue wavelengths, reflecting and transmitting the green wavelengths to our eyes. The absorbed light is what's used for photosynthesis. Red anthocyanins reflect and transmit red light, while they absorb blue and green. The absorbed blue light doesn't do any work in the anthocyanin molecule. It's not making sugars or something else, but it's not available to the chloroplasts either. So red leaves aren't able to use all of the incoming blue light for photosynthesis. The leaves' ability to make sugars is stifled. Green leaves naturally have the advantage over red leaves in cranking out carbohydrates. In fact, research on red and green-leaved coleus has shown exactly that, and red-leaved cultivars grown in the shade tend to be more green than red. Tender emerging leaves are at the mercy of the often hostile world. Insects wait to feast on them. Sunlight can parboil them. Diseases riddle them until they resemble lacework. One of the ways some plants protect their new leaves with a handsy dose of anthocyanin. This temporary condition, called juvenile reddening, is usually most intense in leaves exposed to full sunlight. Part of that is because of the natural sunscreen function I mentioned, but there may be another benefit. Leaves are pretty darn tough when they're mature, but when they're young and expanding, they don't have the tough, waxy cuticles, expanding the rigid cell walls and other natural defenses that older leaves do. Not only does this make leaves easier to attack from the outside, but it also means that water loss is greater too. We can see this happening in the garden on a summer day. The newest stems and leaves on our plants wilt first because they can't control the evaporation through expanding surfaces. If water uptake from the roots doesn't keep up with demand, then these young leaves lose so much water that their tissues are killed. Usually this happens at the tips along the margins of the leaves, where you'll eventually see browning or necrosis as an indicator. Now consider some garden plants that show juvenile reddening, such as Photinia and English ivy. The young expanding leaves rarely wilt, and I've never seen leaf browning from water loss in either plant. In this case, what the anthocyanins might be doing is holding water inside the leaves by adhesion. Remember, the general rule is water always moves to where water isn't. Because red leaves have anthocyanins swimming around in the cellular water, that means they have relatively less water than green leaves. It's harder for water to evaporate away from red tissues than from green ones. A final problem young leaves face is successfully reaching full size. During the brief window of time, the bonds between cell and wall fibers are loosened, allowing them to slip past one another. When leaves are expanding, they rely on the power of water or pressure to force cell wall expansion and reach mature size. If young leaves are not turgid enough, whether it's from too little water uptake or too much water loss, they won't reach maximum size. In fact, the presence of notably small leaves on evergreen trees and shrubs is a good indicator of drought stress. Not only can young red leaves retain their water in cellular lockdown, they also attract more water from adjacent tissues. Increasing the water content plumps up young leaves, creating turgor pressure needed for cell walls to slide past one another and guarantee maximum leaf size. Once the leaves have stopped expanding, the anthocyanins disappear and the red fades to green. So the book I'm reading from is fascinating, and it truly does tell us a lot about how plants work. The author is Linda Chucker Scott. I hope that you might be interested enough to look up this book. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.